Questions Per Minute is a weekly radio show from the New York City chapter of the Democratic Socialists of America. Recorded live at WBAI 99.5 in Brooklyn every Wednesday at 9 p.m. RPM's about doing the work to build a democratic socialist future. Each week, hear the latest news, analysis, and organizing experience from the minds and hearts of activists fighting every day in New York City. Join the movement at socialists.nyc.
Yo, it's Good New York. You're listening to Revolutions Per Minute, live from the new WBAI studios. We're a socialist radio show and podcast for members of the New York City Democratic Socialist Association. DSA is the largest socialist organization in the United States, with 95,000 members nationwide, and NYC DSA is its biggest chapter. We are run by our 9,000 members and organizers who are working together to build democratic socialism in all five boroughs. In an effort to exert its power over the Americas, the United States has enforced an embargo on Cuba ever since its revolutionary struggle for independence from American imperialism. The blockade is an effort to force regime change against the will of the Cuban people, who want to improve their society without foreign interference. Despite the immense suffering caused by the embargo to this very day, socialists in Cuba have made remarkable achievements in education and healthcare. DSA members Rolando, Tom, and Patrick, as well as Daniel Montero, a journalist from Cuba, join us to discuss the movement to end the embargo and fight to preserve Cuban self-determination. But first, the headlines.
New York City, this is Desiree Joy Frias. I'm an organizer with the Bronx Upper Manhattan branch, and I use she, her pronouns. Today's headlines for Wednesday, January 5th. Renewed calls to reduce Rikers population, and Mayor Adams takes office. The Omicron wave has renewed calls to once again reduce the population of people held in Rikers, where COVID rates are higher than the city and vaccination rates are much lower. The city's jail population was dramatically reduced during the first wave of the pandemic in spring of 2020, but it has now risen back to pre-COVID levels. Eric Adams, who was sworn in as mayor of New York at the Times Square New Year's Eve celebration, announced that he would leave in place his predecessor's vaccine mandate for private businesses. New York City's public school system announced a new testing policy that allows students who are exposed to COVID but test negative and are asymptomatic to remain in school, phasing out the current policy of quarantining entire classrooms exposed to COVID. By doubling the system's number of random tests, officials hope to avoid school closures or online learning as Omicron sweeps across the city. As COVID cases continue to rise amidst the Omicron wave, several city-run hospitals may have to delay elective surgeries due to the rise in hospitalizations. The MTA is also reducing service. As it faces a worker shortage and employees get sick, the city's free isolation hotel rooms are facing a surge in demand. Governor Kathy Hochul signed a bill into law requiring the MTA to consider bicycle and pedestrian access in bridge, station, and capital improvement plans. The Westchester District Attorney will not pursue charges against ex-Governor Andrew Cuomo for forcibly kissing two women, although she said the allegations were credible. Governor Kathy Hochul signed the Health Equity Assessment Act, which aims to abate the trend of hospital closures by forcing providers to report how such closures will impact nearby communities. The state of New York will no longer prosecute children under the age of 12. Mayor Eric Adams named Frank Carone as his chief of staff. Carone, former counsel for the Brooklyn Democratic Party, has close ties to former party boss Frank Sedito, and once represented a pair of notorious landlords who sold 17 buildings to the city to be used as affordable housing. That is all for the news today. Thank you for listening, comrades, and Happy New Year.
Our headlines are brought to you by The Thorn, an incredible weekly newsletter by NYC DSA Electoral Working Group covering local politics and radical activism. Subscribe at thethorn.nyc. Well, before we get to our regular scheduled content of the day, our recorded interview with in Cube roundtable on the Cuban embargo, we want to discuss an important thing that we've continued to do at the station, which is this Tower Fund Drive. And the reason you can get this sort of content on the air, that we can have this sort of Cuban roundtable that you're not going to hear on any other kind of media, is because we have access to the signal 99.5 FM. This signal is crucial to hold in the hands of the community. The only way we can do that is if we get enough donations. And if you want to donate, go call 212-209 212-209-2950. Again, the number is 212-209-2950. Or you can go to towerfund.wbai.org. This station has, you know, this is our third year on the station, and, you know, we really appreciate the ability to get on the air and talk about socialism, have socialist organizers get elected officials that normally don't get access to the airwaves as much as other elected officials tend to do. So what we do on this station is really, really crucial. We're trying to highlight the work of people that are normally silenced by the media. And so if you want to continue to support that kind of media work, the kind of free speech media that we have here on WBAI, I would go to call 212-209-2950. Again, that's 212-209-2950, or go to towerfund.wbai.org. And I just want to now get to our recorded segment on Cuba and the embargo. Let's get that clip rolling. So we're here for our Cuba roundtable to discuss history of Cuban socialism, the now of Cuban socialism, the embargo, and the fight to end it, both in Cuba and here in the United States. I just want to thank everyone so much for joining us.
Thank you.
So before we get into the issue of the day, I just want to give everyone a chance to introduce themselves. So Tom, why don't you get us started?
Absolutely. My name is Tom Wojak. I am from the West Suburban Illinois DSA chapter. I am one of the co-chairs of IC Americas, the Americas subcommittee, which is, of course, within DSA International Committee. Very, very happy to be here.
Sure thing. My name is Patrick Shepherd. I'm a union organizer and a DSA member. I live in Brooklyn. I am a member of the IC Americas subcommittee. And in New York City, I'm on the organizing committee for the anti-war working group.
My name is Rolando Pratt. I'm Cuban-born in New York, a New Yorker since 1996. Officially an American citizen since 2004. Back in Cuba, I was a college professor, a writer, a translator. My professional life here in the U.S. or previously in Europe has turned around the same access. Politically speaking, at the end of the 80s, the late 80s in Cuba, I was part of several independent socialist and communist projects trying to open a space in Cuba for debate, for political debate, and for, let's put it philosophically, for the expansion of the social subject of the revolutionary project. I joined DSA last year. I'm a proud member of the Manhattan chapter, Lower Manhattan chapter of DSA. I think it's Lower Manhattan. I'm not sure now. Yes. I have been trying to contribute to this ongoing campaign against embargo, against the U.S. embargo on Cuba. I work for the UN, and from my office at the UN, I'm talking to you now.
Hello, I'm Daniel Montero. I'm a journalist and producer with Belly of the Beast. We are an independent American media covering Cuba-U.S. relations. I'm Cuban. I'm based in Havana, which is where I'm speaking to you from.
All right, well, thank you so much, everyone, for the introductions. Now let's just dive into the subject at hand. So, you know, what is the U.S. embargo of Cuba? Why did it emerge as U.S. policy, and how has it changed during recent presidential administrations?
Well, thank you very much. Well, the U.S. embargo against Cuba was born right with the revolution from 1959 and on. So we haven't really seen the Cuban Revolution without it. These are two processes that have happened simultaneously. It basically means that the United States has been waging an economic war against Cuba for 60 years in the shape of sanctions, in the shape of, in practice, Cuba not being able to do business with United States citizens and companies, but also with the United States having the ability to impose sanctions on companies from other countries doing business with Cuba. Of course, it's a lot more complicated than that, but I'm trying to summarize it as much as I can. It has had worst and less worse moments through history, particularly in the 90s, sanctions increased. And there's only been one moment where things have slowed down, which was during Barack Obama. Sadly, the presidency of Donald Trump not only took back the steps towards engagement taken by Obama, he also made things a lot worse by imposing new sanctions. Sadly, the Trump presidency was one of the worst periods for Cuba when it comes to U.S. politics. And as I said before, the embargo is basically economic warfare that's being carried out by the most powerful country in the world versus small Caribbean island in the global south. That'd be the best way I could find to summarize it.
I mean, to what Daniel just said, and rightly so, I just would like to add that the embargo was set in motion long before Cuba became officially, let's say, the communist country, even though I myself don't believe in this type of label, communist country. Countries are not communist or not. It's the government can espouse a communist line or not. So, but the point is that long before, years before, Cuba became officially a communist country or ruled by the Communist Party, the U.S. was already trying to punish Cuba for just trying to be independent from the U.S. So the reasons for the embargo, historically speaking, have nothing to do with communists in Cuba, but with the fight after the revolution, immediately after the revolution, for Cuban independence. The fact of the matter is obvious. Before the revolution, Cuba was a practical colony of the U.S., and the American embassy in Havana had as much or more power than the president of Cuba. I don't want to dwell or to go into detail into this long history. I think these are well-known facts, but they should be highlighted. Why? Because today, the embargo, those who stand for the embargo speak mainly about Cuba being a communist dictatorship. The other thing is that whatever are the conditions today in Cuba, and they are certainly dire conditions, materially speaking, economically speaking, they are the direct result to a great extent of the embargo itself. So there is a great hypocrisy in the fact of promoting the embargo to solve Cuba's problems, while the embargo itself is the source, is the main source of such problems. To end my intervention now, I'd like to say that something that has changed, in my opinion, and this is, I think, a point that should be stressed, is that the proponents and the partisans of the embargo are an ever smaller segment, both of the U.S. political establishment and even within the Cuban-American community in South Florida and other parts of the U.S. So at some point in the beginning, you could say that the overwhelming majority of the Cuban-American community in the U.S. and elsewhere was in favor of the embargo out of political reasons, ideological reasons. That is no longer the case. Nevertheless, the embargo has been reinforced when the opponents of the embargo are more and more and more within the U.S. society, the world society, the international community, not to mention Cuba itself.
And then also to add, maybe to address the second part of the question, how have things changed during recent presidential administrations? You know, of course, under Trump, the whole regime of sanctions was just put on steroids. He re-added Cuba to the list of state sponsors of terrorism, and they got very creative in all of the new ways they could find to possibly turn screws and further eviscerate the Cuban people. Example that comes to mind is, you know, Cuba was able to do trade with Venezuela, you know, and ostensibly the U.S. has nothing to do with the relationship between Cuba and Venezuela, two sovereign countries with the right under any reasonable international law to trade with each other. But what the U.S. could do was go after the shipping companies that transported oil and cooking gas between the countries from Venezuela to Cuba. And then even more recently, under Biden, nothing has changed. Biden's policies are Trump's policies on Cuba. In some respects, they have gotten worse. And in the news today, actually, Biden's administration went after Airbnb and got a $90,000 plus settlement out of Airbnb for operating in Cuba.
So I think, you know, what's made clear here from all of our guests is that what's going on is that this is a policy of U.S. imperialism and to exercise U.S. domination over Cuba and the region more broadly. And that this has been the kind of over the years with very little exception, this has been the justification, maybe not stated that it was supposedly to contain communism, but it's more in reality is about exercising U.S. power in the region. So how is the, we've discussed the recent presidential administration and the kind of the lack of shift between Trump and Biden, but how has the blockade affected the COVID response and what are the conditions in Cuba today? And Daniel, I'll throw that to you.
Yes, thank you. Well, even before COVID, Cuba had been in a crisis, you know, an economic crisis, scarcities, and the United States policies, basically the embargo, is one of the main causes of these conditions. But of course, if you add to that the COVID pandemic, which of course has affected everyone, but in the particular case of Cuba, was particularly damaging to, tourism was one of our main incomes, remittances, which were taken out by Trump as one of its many sanctions. So basically what you have is a country that which crisis and scarcities skyrocketed during this very long 2 years. Of course, you even had protests last July precisely caused by these conditions created by the United States and other reasons. So right now, I think things are a little bit better, but you can still feel the crisis. Now, in terms of how has the United States policies affected COVID response, you can see it in every way. First of all, the amount of money that can be destined to fight COVID is not the ideal because you have a lot of things to address within the country. But more specifically, some of the raw materials that were necessary to develop vaccines, where Cuba was not able to acquire them or was harder for them to acquire them due to U.S. sanctions. Now, I'm sorry, I should mention for those who are listening that don't know that Cuba has developed five COVID vaccines, which is remarkable. And it would be remarkable for any country in the world, in the North or in the global South, in spite of U.S. sanctions. But the production of those vaccines was slowed down because of this. Like you have something like we had vaccines and at some point we didn't have the syringes to vaccinate people. And this tells you that even though we are we have a very highly developed biopharma industry, we are a poor country. And we are a poor country whose response to COVID was being damaged by the most powerful country in the world, right? And so those are some of the ways in which the United States has damaged the production. We've even spoken to the scientists themselves who we're working tirelessly to get the vaccines out and to get people vaccinated. And they would say, if people would only know, if people in the United States knew what their government was doing to us, to the people, to us, the scientists, they would be heartbroken. They would not agree with what the government is doing, because United States sanctions during COVID have literally cost lives. Because even if it slowed down, if it slowed things down for 2 months, 3 months, that is counted in death, sadly. So I think, you know, many times people speak about the cost that the embargo or the blockade has on the Cuban people, but very few times in history you could be able to say that the United States policy towards Cuba has cost lives. And that is the case with this period of time with COVID.
Just to very briefly echo one of Daniel's points, every dollar that is spent trying to combat the embargo is a dollar taken away from Cuban public health programs. And this is one of the punitive measures of the embargo. It's to wear down the Cuban quality of life. This is, I would say, it wouldn't be unfair to characterize the U.S. embargo as the primary detriment to quality of life on the island. And this is something that we're looking to organize against, and there is a profound urgency to do so.
Just a brief remark on this same topic. The embargo affects the whole chain of production of something like a vaccine, but also its potential commercialization. So Cuba, obviously, not only could help other countries, and in the end, Cuba already did it in places like Nicaragua, Venezuela, but Cuba could get some revenue from exporting its vaccines. So the embargo also is an impediment to that.
What you've all hit on here, I think, highlights a few important things to note. One, that even under these conditions, it is remarkable that Cuba was able to develop a vaccine, and that which kind of shows the what have been the achievements of the Revolutionary Society. I think this is something to know, the commitment to healthcare, which is a much higher priority than something in a place like the United States. So I think the fact that even under these conditions, a vaccine was able to be developed and Cuba did such a superior job of preventing the spread of the disease as was in the United States, but still under, even when healthcare is a priority, the embargo has created much more suffering than necessary. And I think it's clear that the embargo is something that suffocates Cuban society in so many different directions, that even when Cuba has something like an incredible commitment to healthcare, that even in that sphere, you experience extra suffering and unnecessary suffering. So, Daniel, I'll throw this your way. What do Cubans want to see from activists in the United States?
I believe that the first thing we would like to see is just people standing up and calling things the way they are. You know, what you often hear from United States politicians is a complete hypocrisy. They're always talking about helping the Cuban people. They're saying the embargo is in place because they are only affecting the government, and you know all of Cuba's problems are because of the Cuban dictatorship, and they would all be solved the day they're gone. Now this is a huge lie that goes unquestioned most of the time, and mainstream media ignores these lies and refuses to address Cuba like the nuanced society that we are, which is not, it's obviously not perfect, but it is not the failed state the Biden administration and the mainstream media calls it. So I think that the first thing we want to hear from activists and from, you know, everyone that can raise their voice is to acknowledge these complexities. I personally don't want to hear I don't want to hear people justify our problems or anything like that. I would just be grateful for people to acknowledge the complexities of Cuban society, acknowledge the accomplishments of the Cuban government, and not ignore our issues. But since you are American, and since, you know, these are people from the United States, I think my main point will always be to an American audience that our internal issues are our own, and it is our responsibility to solve them. What should be in your hands and what is actually in your hands is to demand from your politicians to lift the embargo, to stop hurting the Cuban people. So I think, and I'm sorry for taking too long to answer this when I'm only saying the same thing, I think it's all about raising your voices and not be afraid of contradicting the lie that has been normalized. And the more people do that, I think the easier it would be to come to a better day in which Cuba and the U.S. can have normal relations and not an economic war.
During his campaign, Biden did promise to change, to revert Trump policies in regard to Cuba. I think he was sincere back then. That's the same politician who was the vice president of Barack Obama. But I have the feeling, almost a conviction, that once Biden was in the White House, his policy towards Cuba was hijacked once again by the Cuban-American lobby, who are under the illusion and their delusion that if they keep pushing, if they keep making things worse in Cuba, the regime is going to fall. It's been 64 years of proof to the contrary. So this is not only hypocritical, it's almost genocide. So they think that the regime is going to fall. That's the strategic goal of American policy, to produce regime change in Cuba. And therefore, the Cuban people, with their suffering, is a hostage to that policy.
And just to add to that, especially when we think about the outright lies and the extreme framing of U.S. inside of U.S. politics regarding relationships to Cuba on the Democrats and the Republican side, I think context is really important. Every year in the U.N., resolution goes to the floor to end the U.S. economic war against Cuba. It passes overwhelmingly every year. This year it was supported by 184 member states, only opposed by two, the U.S. and Israel. I think this makes it clear to us that advocating for an end to the U.S. economic war on Cuba is the right, it is the normal position, and continuing the U.S. policy of an economic war on Cuba is an extreme position. It is not supported by the people of the world, and it is also not supported by the people of the United States. As Rolando pointed out, it's an extreme minority within this country that is actively motivated to continue these policies. Even amongst the Cuban-American community, 74% support an end to the blockade on medicine. Basically, the situation that we see is the policy that we end up with is only supported by a fringe far right wing of anti-Cuba right wing in Florida.
I just want to remind our listeners that you are tuning in to Revolutions Per Minute on listener-sponsored WBAI in New York City, broadcasting at 99.5 FM and streaming on your favorite podcast app. To give to the station, please call 212-209-2950, 212-209-2950, or go to towerfund.wbai.org. Now back to our roundtable on the struggle to end the Cuban embargo.
It's pretty clear that it's an extreme policy in a number of ways. It's deliberately constructed to create suffering, and the goal, I think, exactly as Rileno pointed out, is regime change. And regardless of whether that regime change is actually supported by the people of Cuba itself, it has nothing to do with what the policy is. The policy is about exerting U.S. power. And I think it's, as Daniel pointed out, it's hypocritical and absurd to call Cuba some sort of failed state when it has currently a higher life expectancy and literacy rate than the United States does, and basically than any other country in the entire region. And at the same moment that the U.S. allies itself with governments that are connected to far-right paramilitary organizations and allies itself with right-wing dictatorships around the globe and sells them massive amounts of weapons, that this policy is not stated based on any moral reality. It's totally about power projection of the U.S. imperial apparatus. So I think for DSA, it's clear that a stance needs to be taken to kind of free Cuba from the dramatic costs of this embargo, which is an extreme policy. So I'll direct this towards Tom first. Can you speak on DSA's position on Cuba's solidarity as an organization and what has been done up until now?
Absolutely. I am very, very happy to report that the issue of Cuba is probably one of the most solidified foreign policy positions within DSA. It's been a very, very long time that we've been developing this position, but we've come to what I believe is a very, very strong consensus within the organization to oppose the embargo for whatever reasons you would like. We're trying to build a left-wing coalition of forces who are interested in tearing down this barbaric and immoral blockade. Since the passage of the Cuba Solidarity Resolution in 2019, of which I was the author and sponsor, there have been many, many objectives of this escalating towards a campaign, which is now starting to take shape in the DSA International Committee. One of the predominant things that I'm very, very proud of is our ability to interface with national coalitions within the U.S. DSA is right now a member of the National Network on Cuba, a large umbrella organization of many, many different types of groups that have all unified under the banner of ending the embargo. We're also very, very interested in organizing educational events. We're just trying to get as much materials into the hands of the local chapters as we possibly can. The DSA International Committee had a very, very successful educational event, of which Daniel Montero was, we were very grateful to have him as a panelist. And it ended up being one of the most successful panels that we've had in the history of the International Committee. So there is a pronounced appetite within DSA. There is a fervor and perhaps even an acknowledgement that DSA is uniquely positioned to help end the embargo, to join this sort of cause, to connect with the international forces that are calling for the end of the U.S. embargo. And it's very, 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 very wonderful to see all these forces beginning to congeal. Presently, we are actually working on a campaign that we are going to be fleshing out here in January. We're sort of designing a coalition of DSA forces that can in turn work with a variety of other groups in the United States and outside of the United States to target things like the medical embargo, to ask for things like remittances, anything that we can do to exert political pressure on the Biden administration, which I think DSA is, as I said, not only uniquely equipped to do, but very much ready for. And I've been very, very proud to see that work being done.
Rolando or Patrick, anything that you want to add?
Well, on November, last November 15th, the New York State Anti-War Group did stage a rally across from the Cuban mission to the UN. On the same date, in that same place, a group of pro-embargo people were supporting not only the embargo, but those people back in Cuba were trying to go out and demonstrate on the streets, whether or not they did say it clearly for regime change, including some of them are not particularly ambiguous about it, about possible humanitarian intervention in Cuba, which means, in fact, military intervention by the U.S. So I think that was an important point. I let Patrick say other things.
Certainly. You know, that demonstration, I think, was telling of the energy behind the subject and, you know, the power that you get when a narrative that reflects reality and truth is on your side. You know, that rally, I think it was three or four times as many people showed up for an end to the embargo and for a return to moves toward normalization. And that rally that we participated in New York City, simultaneously, DSA chapters across the country held their own rallies on the same day. People participated in D.C., people participated in Philly, and people participated in Miami. We had basically three main demands on that day. Number one, lifting restrictions on remittances. A key component of the escalation under Trump was further efforts to stop people, Cubans in the United States, from sending money back to their families. Those restrictions continue today. We advocated for easing the restrictions on medical supplies, and we our third demand for the day was removing Cuba from the state sponsor of terrorism list, which is an absurd and ridiculous policy that, again, was brought about under Trump and is continued by Biden to this day.
I think, and just to say one last thing, I do happen to think there's a lot of hope going forward. I do happen to think that there is a lot of reason to be optimistic, especially in the wake of, you know, the November 15th protests, in which in many instances, you know, socialists out-organized reactionary forces in a very, very real way. Cuba is a very, very interesting issue in that respect, even after, you know, some of the Cuban protests where, you know, U.S. right-wing media was really trying to scale up engagement with the issue of Cuba. Most Americans, even post that, opposed the embargo of Cuba in some way, which November 15th solidifies what we already knew to be true, which is that Americans simply do not have an appetite for this egregious assault on Cuban dignity and right to life. And I think that DSA members listening should be very, very happy about that. There is a place to organize. There is a large network, international network, that we can very easily connect to. And I do believe that it will be very, very worthwhile, not only for Cuba, not only for DSA, but for everyone.
In regard to that, I'd like to point out that the fight against embargo, in my opinion, has become trans-ideological. So, for instance, when Patrick was mentioning the well-known fact that every year the Assembly General here at the UN passes a resolution condemning embargo, we could not say that all those 180 and some countries are ideologically aligned with Cuba. Some of them are even critical of the Cuban political system or of the Cuban states and government concrete policies. So the embargo is just a question of international law, common sense, morals. It goes beyond ideology. And the hope Tom was talking about, I think, has a deeper root in the meeting of wills. So DSA is by nature an anti imperialist organization, and the embargo is an anti-imperialistic fight, type of fight. This is not communism versus capitalism. This is about Cuban independence. This is about Cuba's right to pursue its own path. And this is about also about this new political generation in the U.S. affirming itself as a new American political generation who is not interested in being imperialistic in any shape or form.
If I may add something real quick, I'd really like to thank DSA for doing the right thing. Because sadly, not as many people in the U.S. are doing the right thing when it comes to Cuba. We have seen that people and organizations that were vocal in favor of engagement when Barack Obama was president and that were vocal against Donald Trump policies have remained silent since Biden is in office because it is a Democrat government, right? And that is something that really needs to change. And I think that it is actions like the one DSA is taking and that hopefully can be followed up by others and getting more people involved that we're going to get to a better place. Because there is a very organized lobby for the embargo, for sanctions, right? And they have access and they have means to government. So I think it's going to take a lot of voices. It's going to take a lot of people saying, look, you have to pay attention to this and you have to do the right thing for it to change. So bottom line, thanks.
I think it's clear that there's both, you know, a powerful proponents of this embargo who are, you know, entrenched interests with deep connections to the American state who are trying to push forward this imperialist agenda at the same time that there is a growing movement of which DSA is taking a leading role to oppose this very unpopular embargo, both within the United States and internationally. So I think there'll be a lot to check in and moving forward. And so I'll throw this to Patrick first. What role do DSA elected officials have in the struggle to end the embargo? And how can organizers get involved at a local level?
Yeah, definitely. So on the national level, at least for the time being, really the pressure comes down to however we can exert activist pressure, political pressure on the Biden administration. He alone has the power to turn back and de-escalate key components of the embargo. Tomorrow, he could do it tomorrow with a wave of his pen. I think that he's weighing the political costs of doing so at all times. And, you know, part of our task is to make it costly to do nothing. I will say that on the national level, our DSA-endorsed electeds in Congress have, as far as I'm aware, done the right thing on the issue of Cuba as far as votes that have come forward every time. Recently, they all DSA elected officials at the national level signed a letter to Biden. Over 100 members of Congress were signatories on that letter, basically calling to return to Obama-era normalization. Locally, the city council has been looking at has had a resolution on the table for a couple of years now, I think. It's being driven by Rosemary Neely and Joan Gibbs, basically calling for a normalization of relations and an end to the embargo. Hopefully, this year's the year with our newly minted DSA freshmen, DSA-endorsed freshmen on the city council. I think there's a real opportunity and a real shot to put this resolution over the top and get it passed. Chicago has passed a very similar resolution. We're hoping to do the same thing in New York City. Also locally, our anti-war working group this last month successfully had a vote it was over 95% yes, to adopt Cuba normalization as a priority campaign. So New York City DSA members can get involved directly in this effort to have local cultural events, educational events, and participate in political advocacy to in the embargo in New York City. Get involved with the New York City anti-war working group to get involved with this fight.
I would further encourage people to look to DSA International Committee. We are, as I said, very, very interested in organizing a coordinated response with a broad variety of groups within DSA to begin advancing this work. If you are a organizer, a DSA organizer, who is interested in just taking the first steps, we have assembled a study guide, which I'm hoping can be transmitted somewhere through some means. But beyond that, I strongly encourage people. DSA is a member of the National Network on Cuba. I strongly encourage people to look up member organizations within National Network on Cuba and begin building coalitions with them. I strongly encourage people to begin passing local chapter resolutions, prioritizing ending the embargo, and beginning the process that will put your chapter in the best position possible to pursue this work. This is something that I'm the co-chair, one of the co-chairs of IC Americas. This is a campaign that we have voted to prioritize. This is a very, very important thing nationally, and we're just looking for ways to give the locals exactly the sort of ammunition they need in the weeks and months to come. So if you're ready to do Cuba work, now's the time. Get in contact with DSA International Committee, and we'll see what we can do.
Well, it seems like there's a lot of different ways that our listeners could potentially plug into this work, and we will continue to update our listeners on the campaign for to end the embargo against Cuba and the broader work of the International Committee moving forward. I just want to thank you all so much for joining us on Revolutions Per Minute, and hopefully we'll get to hear from you all again.
Thanks so much, Jack.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to Revolutions Per Minute on listener-sponsored WBAI in New York City, broadcasting at 99.5 FM and streaming on your favorite podcast app. Today, we were just hearing a roundtable on the embargo in Cuba and the fight against it. And now let's roll to a fundraising pitch with Rob and Sing in Solidarity.
You're listening to Sing in Solidarity, New York City DSA's official chorus, performing songs by Victor Jara, the famous Chilean teacher, artist, and socialist, who was martyred while protesting the U.S.-backed coup that overthrew Salvador Allende and installed the fascist Augusto Pinochet in Chile in 1973. The music of Victor Jara, along with his fellow musicians in the Nueva Canción tradition, has kept the spirit of socialism alive in Chile and around the world. These songs, with their messages of worker solidarity and power, have become beloved classics and inspired social movements to victory. And we are proud to participate in that legacy. Each week you hear Sing in Solidarity's version of El Pueblo Unido by Victor Jara's contemporary Kila Payun as our opening music and theme song. Hi, I'm Rob, a New York City DSA member. Since last summer, I've been working behind the scenes with the Revolutions Per Minute production collective to help bring you cutting-edge socialist content from the contemporary movement for socialism here in New York City and beyond. Tonight, I'm stepping out from behind the ones and zeros to ask you one more time to support the WBAI Tower Fund in these first few weeks of the new year. You can help WBAI stay on the air and transmitting in 2022 with just a small donation tonight. Please call 212-209-2950. That's 212-209-2950 or go to towerfund.wbai.org to make your donation. As socialists, we know that many people working together can make powerful change. So we hope that you will be able to give some change to our powerful radio station tonight. Whether it's a little or a lot, every donation helps. And now is the time to pitch in to help us pay the rent this year. Please call 212-209-2950. That's 212-209-2950. Or go to towerfund.wbai.org to give now. Let's hear more from Sing in Solidarity, performing songs by Victor Jara. You're listening to Sing in Solidarity, New York City DSA's official chorus, here on Revolutions Per Minute. We're here every Wednesday at 9 p.m. here on WBAI to bring you news and updates from the Democratic Socialists of America and our organizing for socialism in the so-called United States. We're asking you to make your contribution to WBAI's Tower Fund today by calling 212-209-2950. That's 212-209-2950. Or visiting towerfund.wbai.org. Victor Jara's legacy lives on in the recent presidential victory of Gabriel Boric. Boric, who will be Chile's youngest ever president, represents the latest crest of the pink tide of left-wing leaders in the Americas who have achieved victory with support from powerful indigenous, trade unionist, peasant, and feminist movements. We hope this enchanting music and the powerful politics it represents will entice you to make your donation to WBAI's Tower Fund tonight. Don't wait. Do it now. Call 212-209-2950. That's 212-209-2950. Or go to towerfund.wbai.org. On tonight's Revolutions Per Minute, you're hearing about Cuba's recent public health successes with the COVID-19 vaccine and efforts by socialists abroad, including here in New York, to end our government's cruel economic blockade on Cuba, which causes needless suffering for the Cuban working class. Music like the songs of Nueva Canción transcends language and colonial borders and reminds us that we are one international working class struggling together for victory. If you've enjoyed this music tonight, let us know that you appreciate our work and the work of all our local producers here on WBAI, and make a contribution to the Tower Fund by calling 212-209-2950. That's 212-209-2950. Or visiting towerfund.wbai.org. For Revolutions Per Minute, I'm Rob. Now, let's go back to Jack in the studio for more on DSA's Cuban Solidarity.
You've been listening to Revolutions Per Minute on listener-sponsored WBAI in New York City, broadcasting at 99.5 FM and streaming on your favorite podcast app. That's it for this week. We will see you out in the streets organizing your workplace or your building, and we'll be back with you in 2 weeks. Thank you very much. This has been Jack Devine with Revolutions Per Minute.